The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dr. Brené Brown's 2010 TED Talk, The Power of Vulnerability, struck a nerve. It quickly went viral and now has nearly 21 million views. Her follow-up talk has almost 6 million. The University of Houston-based research professor is now author of two best-selling books based on years of data. Her message, authentic human interactions, innovation, professional satisfaction, and meaningful relationships are only possible when we dare to expose our vulnerabilities and confront our shame. The message has been adapted by corporate leadership teams and Green Berets, along with therapists and yoga teachers. Ultimately, boldly doing battle with the self means sometimes landing flat on your face. And her new book, Rising Strong, is about how to get up, dust yourself off, and be willing to do it all over again. Brené Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be with you.
Well, you write in the new book about the physics of vulnerability. Now, what does that mean?
You know, it was just the simplest way I could think of capturing this idea that if we're brave enough, often enough, we're going to fall down. We're going to experience heartbreak, disappointment, failure, screw-ups. It's just that simple. And I think people want to believe, well, if I try to be brave, I might risk getting hurt. But what I have found in my work is that if you are brave enough, you're not going to risk getting hurt. You're going to probably get hurt. And that's especially true, I think, in this world of kind of hypercritical, unforgiving scrutiny.
So we will fall. And you've done a lot of research on how people get back up, which is a process you lay out in the book as the reckoning, the rumble, the revolution. Can you walk us through that briefly?
Yeah, I'd love to. It was interesting to me because the big research question I asked was, what do men and women who fall, who really struggle and get back up and are more courageous after having struggled and rising, what do they have in common? And there was a very clear process that they all really engaged in that almost became a practice in their lives. The first piece is the reckoning, where these men and women recognized that they were emotionally hooked by something, that their emotions were at play as a result of struggle, and they were willing to get curious about what is the emotion that I'm feeling, what has me so hooked, and what's really going on for me around this fall. And the second piece was, I call it the rumble. I was going to call it the dance, but then the more I got into the data, I'm like, no, it's not that balletic. It's like, it's a rumble. And this was the really big piece for me, the aha for me, is that what these men and women kept saying to me over and over was that they immediately reality checked the first story they told themselves about what was happening. And I would ask, like, what do you mean? They're like, well, you know, right when something hard happens, I think I have it all figured out. But if I'm willing to step back and really feel my way through it and dig into the episode even deeper, I figure out new things. And so the rumble is really about being very mindful of that first narrative we make up when something hard happens. Because let me tell you something, when something hard happens, we're neurobiologically wired to give emotion the first crack at understanding what it is. We need a story. Our brain scrambles and makes up a story very quickly to tell us what's happening, why it's happening, who's dangerous, who's safe. And so these men and women rumbled with that story and really dug into it, poked around, and reality checked it. And then the last thing was this process of recognizing that they're emotionally hooked, getting curious, and then digging into a story and rumbling with it wasn't just a process that they used once or twice, it became a practice in their lives. They were always kind of checking out the reliability of that inner narrator.
I want to go back to that idea of the narrative, the story, because all of the things that you just mentioned involve the kind of stories that we establish for ourselves. And you write a lot about the power of story on this biological and emotional level. Tell us more about what you found from researchers, your own and others, about how the brain kind of rewards our old stories.
You know, it was so fascinating to me because when something difficult happens, our brain is wired for one thing above all else, and that's survival. And so when there's a perceived threat, and a perceived threat can be, you know, getting fired, or it can be a strange look from our boss walking out of a meeting, we can feel, well, something's going on. And so our brain immediately goes into figure this out, get safe mode. And so our brain rewards us for patterns that help ensure our safety. And the brain recognizes that kind of narrative structure of beginning, middle, and end. And so when we make up a story, so let's say you and I walk out of a meeting and you give me a funny look, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I knew Virginia didn't like me. I knew she didn't think I was smart. I knew she didn't think my ideas were very good. My brain immediately makes up a story. The dangerous thing is that we're rewarded chemically for that story, and we're rewarded whether it's accurate or not.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Brené Brown. Maybe you've heard of her. Her videos on vulnerability have been seen by tens of millions of people. Well, now she's found that if you're going to be vulnerable, you're going to fall. So how do you get back up? Her new book is all about that. It's called Rising Strong. Another thing in the book about the way that we process emotion is that there's this habit, I guess, of offloading emotions. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I think what's true for all of us in general is that we're better at inflicting pain on people than we are at feeling our own pain, or better at lashing out and hurting others rather than feeling our own hurt. So over time, we develop ways rather than to feel pain and feel our emotion and get curious about it, we have ways to offload it. Maybe we rage, maybe we push things, I call it chandeliering, we push things down so far thinking that we can stay stoic and we can, you know, the stiff upper lip. And then one seemingly innocuous comment or something happens at work, and then all of a sudden we jump through our skin and we rage and we let loose. I think most of us have worked for someone like that. The other thing that we do is we numb. We use, you know, alcohol, television, sex, the internet, a myriad of things. We numb emotion rather than feeling it. Sometimes we use anger and blame. When something goes wrong, rather than feeling disappointed, we try to figure out whose fault it is, and we go into blaming. And so there's a lot of different ways, rather than feeling emotion, we push it off. And I think the hard thing is that emotion really dictates a lot of our behavior and thinking. So if we don't have some control and understanding of our emotion, we don't have a lot of control over our thinking, our behavior.
So if these are responses that we've been doing for years and stories, you know, get rewarded mm-hmm. that we've been making up for years, how do we recognize them? How do we discern the stories and the bad behavior from the truth?
That was a huge research question for me, is that, okay, I understand that these people engage in this process, but how does it work? And I have to say, close to 70% of the participants really documented those really kind of first stories. I call them SFDs, kind of stormy first drafts, the ones where we really are making up something to help us understand it. And by writing it down, and you know, there's a lot of research on the power of writing things down. And I don't mean a dissertation. I mean like on a post-it note or text it to yourself, jot it in a journal. I'm thinking about James Pennebaker's work from UT, University of Texas, Austin, that writing allows us to see, okay, here is what I've got in front of me. Here's what I'm making up about what's happening. What do I know to be true? It was so fascinating for me because when you look in the research, you find that a story that has limited actual data points, where we go behind and fill in with our ideals and values, that's basically the definition of a conspiracy. And so one of the things that these men and women do who have the capacity to rise strong is they really check, reality check that conspiracy. Is it true that that look meant this? Am I assigning all this to something, or is it true? And I think what we find is the more courageous way to live, if we walk out of a meeting and you look funny, you know, you give me a, throw a funny look my way, is for me to walk up and say, hey, Virginia, we were walking out of that meeting this morning, and I thought you kind of looked at me in a funny way, and I made up that you have a concern with something I shared in there, or that you're concerned about my idea. I just want to check in with you and see what's going on. Which gives you the opportunity to say, no, I just, I was late for another meeting and my tennis elbow is acting up. And then all of a sudden, this huge conflict and this swirling narrative that, you know, but we don't do that normally. We don't check things out. What we do is now I'm angry and now you ask me to do a favor for you. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And now you're thinking, what's going on with Brené? And it's just a very simple question to ask people, you know, as people are listening today, like how many of you have ever gotten in a conflict with someone and that person walked out of your office or out of the living room and you have an entire narrative made up about what's happening?
I've never done anything like that, Brené.
Me neither. I'm just saying theoretically.
but you know, what you're talking about is more vulnerability and exposure. I mean, there's the risk that that person might say to you, oh, you know what, Brené, you really did disappoint me in that meeting. I mean, you're making me think of this expression, I don't know if you've heard it, that you can't save your rear end and your face at the same time.
Oh, yeah, no, you can't.
But so more vulnerability, really? Is that the answer?
Yes.
We have to just expose ourselves more? But
yes,
what's the danger?
I know the danger. Okay, so the danger is that I circle back with you and say, hey, we walked out of the meeting. You looked at me funny. Were you upset about something that happened? And you said, you know what? As a matter of fact, I really did not appreciate the way that you kind of threw that story on the table when, you know, we're still working on it. And I've asked everyone not to share it until we have it complete. But that's better. It's uncomfortable. But let me tell you, the number of uncomfortable moments in our lives is directly correlated to the level of bravery and courage we have with our lives. Because then at least that way I have the ability to say, oh my God, I'm sorry. I apologize. You're right. I got really excited about it and I didn't think about it. Or I have the ability to say, you know what, Virginia, I wasn't in that meeting last week and I didn't realize it. I apologize. Let me help you clean it up and let's move forward. But either way, we're better off for it.
Well, you have advised us how to own ourselves, to dig in deep, be willing to fall, now how to get up. So where to next?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. And for someone who writes about vulnerability and uncertainty, you'd think I'd be comfortable not knowing, but I'm not comfortable. But I actually don't know. And I think I'm just going to let it emerge.
Well, what a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. I appreciate it.
Dr. Brené Brown, she's a research professor at the University of Houston, and her TED Talks have been seen almost 27 million times. She has 2 New York Times bestsellers to her credit, and her new book is called Rising Strong. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Maybe you've seen that trailer for The Intern. Anne Hathaway's character is asking, how in one generation have men gone from guys like Jack Nicholson and Harrison Ford to cut to shot of schlubby guys in sweats? Not atypical of today's dating slash hookup scene, which is casual and relies on instant gratification apps like Tinder and J-Date. But a segment of millennials has been taken in by a mid-century depiction of manhood. For them, Don Draper, the fictional character played for 7 seasons by John Hamm on television's Mad Men, epitomizes an era of American masculinity. Don is powerful, well-dressed, promiscuous, and inscrutable. Producer Eric Malinsky attempted to understand why fans of the show ditch their T-shirts and jeans for slim-cut suits and ties.
So I was talking to this guy at a bar, Neil Scapora. He's from the Bay Area. He says dude all the time. But when Neil watches the show Mad Men, he wishes he could wear a suit to work.
Dude, I don't have the function for it. That's the bummer. In California, so few people really have a calling to actually wear a formalized suit.
Neil's being modest. His boss instituted a dress code for the whole office just because Neil wore shabby T-shirts. He started wearing collared shirts, but they're always a little subversive, like a rat instead of an alligator. I asked him what would happen if Don Draper was his boss.
He probably would have beaten me in the alley. I would have been like an affront to his manhood. He probably would have just pummeled me with his chin for a while.
Hey, Don, look who's here.
It isn't the man in the gray flannel suit.
What the hell is that for?
Don Draper is nothing like me either. He's reserved while I'm effusive. He's formal. I'm casual. He erased his childhood. I still have my Star Wars action figures. But I also wish I could be more like him. I even started consulting a blog called What Would Don Draper Do?
Well, you'd want advice from this man who seems anointed.
Michael Dempster created the blog. It's a side project. In his day job, he writes for Howard Stern, who is about as far from Don Draper as you can get.
Yeah, my first impulse is always to make a joke about or, you know, transsexuals or something, but never to shut my mouth.
The blog is a lot cleaner. It works more like a Dear Abby column. For instance, someone wrote, Dear Don, I'm considering a long-distance relationship with someone who lives across the country. She's fantastic, but is it worth the distance and expense? Dempster does his best to channel Don Draper.
I like the idea of entering into any relationship with an assumed distance. A comfortable remove is a wise position. Long sounds too far for comfort.
It's interesting the way you, like, furrow your brow.
Well, I squint a little bit, but yeah, it's a very sober attitude that he has, even though he's not really ever sober.
Matt Caldicott is another Don Draper fan. He's jealous of Don's sense of privacy, something we've lost today.
There isn't much mystery in this day and age. I mean, most people can find out just about anything about you by going on Google.
Matt works in Spin, doing PR for internet companies. He says today, there's no way Don could be so secretive and maintain a professional reputation.
He would have to be out all the time. He would have to be on Twitter commenting on industry trends and issues. He'd have to do all sorts of things that, you know, going to sit in a bar after work just really wouldn't do for him.
I asked each of these guys what was the coolest thing Draper ever did. It wasn't the philandering, because we see how destructive that is to his family. It wasn't even the drinking and smoking at the office. It was the fact that at the end of season two, Don went on this business trip to California and disappeared for 3 weeks.
Mr. Draper, you're a sight for sore eyes.
Hello, Joan. It's good to be back.
Do you want to know if you've been missed? That's half your correspondence. Mr. Sterling has been very anxious to speak to you on a daily basis.
Call Roger in a half an hour and tell him I'll meet him in a half an hour. And Mr. Phillips, maybe I'll run into him in the men's room.
I mean, I know of situations where people are actually sending emails that basically say things to the effect of whereabouts. I can't imagine Don sitting down at his desk, sending out a one-line email saying, going to the movies for 3 hours this afternoon. Be back sometime before 5.
I think you're not suited for this job.
What did I do?
In addition to being incompetent, you threatened my reputation, and not just today.
Mr. Draper, I try to cover for you all the time.
You do not cover for me. You manage people's expectations.
Is this not the whitest TV show you've ever seen? You know, there are some massive changes in the workplace of today that are not ever likely to be repeated.
Michael Kimmel is a sociologist. He doesn't think that fans of the show want to go back to a time when white men held power through racism or sexism. But those of us born after 1970 are seeing something very appealing in the workplace of the early 60s. In Don Draper's world, security, status, and stability are easy to obtain. If Don wants to, he could stay at Sterling Cooper for his entire career.
The guys in Mad Men, you know, they have an idea of what they want by the time they're 30, by the time they're 40. And you could ask them. And, you know, Seth Rogen, he can't tell you where he's going to be next week.
You know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
So how do you...
How do I pay rent? When I was in high school, I got ran over by a postal truck. I got like 14 grand.
Kimmel interviewed hundreds of young men for his book, Guyland. They're a lot like Judd Apatow characters. They have big dreams to be a filmmaker or an internet mogul, but they're just not sure how to get there.
The economy is so, it makes you so anxious. It's so tenuous. Any hold you might have can be taken away in an instant.
So they go from job to job, waiting for their big break. They're not boys anymore, but they'll never be men in gray flannel suits.
They're living with a level of anxiety that Don Draper never had to face. That's an infantilizing situation. That is, we're putting them in a situation where it's hard to be grown-ups, and then we're saying, okay, be grown-ups.
Banana Republic now sells Mad Men-style suits. Maybe if guys like me dress like Don Draper, we can feel more like grown-ups. But the great thing about Don Draper is that he secretly wants to escape from his suit. That's why we like him.
If I leave this place, it will not be for more advertising.
What else is there?
I don't know, life being lived.
And that story came to us from producer Eric Malinsky.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the trans celebrities Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox in the spotlight, more and more individuals are coming forward with their own stories about gender ambiguity, which from a biological perspective is a lot more common than most people think. Studies at Brown University found that one out of every 2,000 people is born with ambiguous genitalia or other traits that fall somewhere on the male-female spectrum, but many of them grow up without knowing it. Doctors regularly perform surgeries on infants that will determine which gender that child will identify with for life. An increasing number of parents, legal experts, and bioethicists are questioning whether intersex babies should be operated on. The first public lawsuit on that question is scheduled for November. Azeen Ghorashi, a science reporter for BuzzFeed News and author of the article Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? And Azeen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you focus on a lawsuit over a child called MC in the article, stemming from the circumstances of the child's birth. Now, what was the condition?
So MC was born with ovotesticular disorder of sexual development. It's an incredibly rare form of intersex. It's about one in every 20,000 babies are born with this particular condition. So it's basically that he has both ovarian and testicular tissue. He's pretty much split down the middle in terms of which biological traits are female and which biological traits are male. So it presents a little bit more difficult of a quandary for doctors at birth about what to do and sort of, you know, guessing what gender he's going to grow up to identify with.
And you call him he. What did they do for MC?
So MC was actually a ward of the state by the time doctors were trying to determine whether to operate on him. So the state was really making the decisions about his care, which is part of the lawsuit, actually. The doctors looked at all of his genetic information, looked at his anatomy, which included a penis and a vagina. It included one testicle and, like I said, both ovarian and testicular tissue. And they basically determined that he could have gone either way. If you look at the doctor's notes, when MC was 60 months old, they basically said that it was very, very hard to determine sort of which way he was going to swing, and they could swing it kind of in either direction based on how they decided to operate is sort of the language that they were using. One key thing was that he did have fairly high levels of testosterone at birth that are usually normal for males of his same age. But ultimately, they decided to go with a female gender assignment. So they removed all of his male anatomy and assigned him as a female. Of course, now I'm using the male gender pronoun. He is now 10 years old and identifies as a boy.
Well, Azeen, data from Brown University estimates one in every 2,000 babies born in the U.S. have a range of traits, you know, falling somewhere on this spectrum of male and female. But you found some doctors argue that it could be even higher.
Right. So it sort of depends on where you decide to draw the line on what is intersex and what isn't. Doctors and scientists are basically finding out that there are more and more and more ways that there isn't this perfect binary of sex of male and female. But some doctors do say that it could be as many as 1 in 100 babies that are born with intersex conditions.
Well, tell us about this lawsuit. This is Pam and Mark Crawford, who adopted MC, or are they foster parents?
They adopted him, yeah.
In the state of South Carolina. So what is the argument the Crawfords are making?
So they adopted MC. I think they brought him home at the age of 20 months. And he was, at that point, they had brought home a baby girl. They knew about his condition. And they actually, Pam had grown up and one of her friends had actually had an intersex condition. And so she was a little bit more aware of sort of the issues around it. First thing she said when she found out about MC's condition was, have they done surgery? And they said yes, and she was pretty disappointed about that. Mm-hmm. But anyways, they brought home this baby girl. They raised her as a baby girl until about the age of 4 or so. I think MC started sort of asserting a little bit more boyish behaviors, you know, playing with trucks and wanting to be on the boys' team and all these things that they didn't make too much of, just because Pam and Mark are both, I'd say, a little bit on the hippie side. They're like, you know, not one to dress her up in a pink dress or anything like that. They were definitely, they'd raised a tomboy before and weren't going to read too much into anything like that. But as he got older, he sort of started making these stronger and stronger assertions. He asked to have his hair cut like Dad's, which, you know, they explained that he might be mixed up with a boy, and MC said that he didn't mind. They went on a family trip to a water park, and MC begged his mom to please be allowed to exist there as a boy. At this point, I think the parents started to see that maybe there was something going on. And I think at the age of 7, he decided that he wanted to, that he was a boy, and that's really just what he was. So he went in front of his class and he told them, and it was his words actually, the born in between that we used in our headline was actually straight out of the mouth of a 7-year-old, which is about the simplest way to put it.
So what's the nature of the suit, and why is it against the doctor who made the decision?
So they are not suing over the fact that they got his gender wrong, right? That MC was surgically altered to be a girl and that he is now grown into being a boy. They are suing over the issue of informed consent. They are alleging that the doctors did not do enough to inform his caregivers at the time, which were social workers for the state of South Carolina and foster parents. They're alleging that they did not pose enough of an option of not doing the surgery and did not make clear enough the sort of potential negative consequences of doing the surgery itself.
In their mind, what would those negative consequences be?
Well, MC, for example, now cannot procreate as a male. Obviously, that's a big one. There's psychological impacts of the surgery happening. The possibility that he was going to grow into being a boy and the sort of gender dysmorphia that comes with that is something he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life. He's going to have to go on to hormone therapy at this point once he hits puberty to continue to live as a boy. These are all risks that the Crawfords are alleging the doctors should have informed his caregivers of.
We're speaking with Azine Gureishi. She's science reporter for BuzzFeed News. And she wrote about a lawsuit involving a commonly performed surgical procedure on babies who are born intersex or with ambiguous genitalia. So the doctors make decisions pretty much on the spot. Are there any qualms within the field of medicine about this informed consent, you know, picking one gender over the other?
Actually, I mean, the standard of care has changed a lot since this practice pretty much started in the mid-50s. You know, the kids that were originally operated on when this sort of rolled out in American medicine, their parents kept it secret from them. The doctors told the parents to do was to never let them know that these surgeries had happened. You know, there weren't counseling services. There weren't all these things that now doctors will point out have really changed in terms of how we deal with intersex babies. Parents are now, at least at the good hospitals in the U.S. that are a little bit more forward-thinking about this stuff, they're given a lot more resources in terms of how to deal with their kids' condition and how to support them. And the parents themselves are supported. And some more progressive doctors, I talked to one guy out of UCSF and in San Francisco, and he's sort of this new school that says that, you know, we need to only do sort of minimally invasive surgeries. They used to, if a girl was born with an extra large clitoris, for example, they would cut that down to make her look more acceptably like a girl. Now, Dr. Sandro in San Francisco, for example, he won't do that. He'll leave it alone. He says that doesn't meet the bar for what we should operate on. But he does do these sort of minimally invasive reversible surgery so that there is room left over for a kid to make a choice later on in life.
Is that the alternative, to do a minimally invasive surgery that can be reversed rather than just letting them go and be gender ambiguous until they can make a decision with their parents, presumably
right.
later?
I mean, if you talk to the intersex activists, they don't even agree with what Dr. DeSandro is proposing. I mean, a minimally invasive surgery is still a surgery. Why are we operating at all? The issue of informed consent, if you take it even further, I mean, this is an infant that has no agency in terms of making decisions about their own body, right? They're 16 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So the activists really do push that further to exactly what you just said, to let the kid have the choice and make the decision with their parents and their doctors once they are a fully formed human being, once their form of gender identity is more solidified.
Of course, this is, you said, been done since the 1950s. Is there any data at all on outcomes for people who did not have the surgery as a child versus people who had the surgeries?
This is also part of the problem, is that there's so little scientific backing for sort of whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. There have been a couple of studies. They tend to contradict each other because it's a really small sample size. It's both a rare condition, and there hasn't been that much research into it. So doctors are really, as of 2011, are starting to sort of team up with researchers to determine sort of those long-term outcomes and see sort of what works best. A lot of what we do have is personal testimonies, and those are a little bit harder to make sense of, obviously, because people will peg them as the good eggs or the bad eggs. But, you know, there are some individuals that grew up without any surgical alteration. And I spoke to one of them for my story, and she claimed she lived a totally normal life. She said that as far as the differences she did have to deal with, you know, going through high school, a lot of the claims made are about that these kids might be bullied for being different. She said that, you know, the most different thing that was perceived about her was the fact that her parents were immigrants, and that was a much harder thing to sort of struggle with in high school.
It's a very big case, and I'm wondering what might happen if the Crawfords do win the case. Will it be so decisive that medical professionals will be forbidden from these surgeries, or think twice about it, or there will be some medical ethical review board for making these decisions?
Right. I mean, no one really knows what will happen if they win, but they certainly won't be restricted by the law, in the sense that it won't be illegal for these surgeons to continue to operate. What will likely happen is that doctors will stop sort of operating out of fear of similar malpractice suits being brought against them. You know, if this is successful, it sets a precedent for more successful lawsuits, essentially.
Well, Azine, thank you so much. We'd love to check in with you after the case goes to trial.
Yeah, of course.
Azine Gureshi, she's science reporter for BuzzFeed News, and she recently wrote the article called Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? There's a link to read her article along with some really interesting photographs at wordofmouthradio.org.